Washington, D.C. This is Warbird Radio.
On this episode of Warbird Radio Presents, we're going into a long odds dogfight between 20 FW-190s and a single P-38 on Germany's doorstep, 1944. Stay tuned. Warbird Radio Presents, The James Kunkel Story, starts now. I'm John Mollison, and I interview old guys, draw their airplanes, and sometimes I'm lucky enough to hit the record button and let you hear what I hear. That first reaction is oftentimes the most crucial. Do you flinch, or do you catch the ball? Do you panic, or do you keep your cool? Do you forget your lines, or can you improvise? My drawing of Kunk's Clunk began with a commission from a patron looking for a documented P-38 to put on his wall. So I contacted one of my favorite history writers, Jay Stout, and he suggested I call this guy named Jim Kunkel, and, well, obviously it all worked out. So, stand by to hear from Jim himself, 370th Fighter Group. But in the meantime, think about this. If it were you versus 20, what would you do?
Well, I was just one of the replacement pilots that were sent to Europe before D-Day, so in case we had heavy losses. And I went. I was assigned to the 370th Fighter Group, 401st Fighter Squadron, 9th Air Force. And at the time, I was a little disappointed. You want to shoot down airplanes, and the 8th Air Force was shooting down most of the airplanes. The 9th wasn't. So we were the mud Air Force and did the close support and supported all the ground operations. We were stationed at Andover, Hamps, which was just about 25 miles north of Southampton. And it had been a permanent RAF station. In fact, it had been, as I understand, the RAF War College prior to the war. And it was a big mile-square grass airport, no runways. And our group was assigned to that facility because, I suppose, because of the tricycle gear, because it wasn't a perfectly level airport. Great for Spitfires.
How about for P-38s?
38s were good. I mean, we could actually put 4 or 8 line abreast and take off if you wanted to do it. But it worked very well. There were 3 little hills, and a 38 would go up and down 2 or 3 of them before it got airborne.
So here's a question about the P-38. This just occurred to me. On a grass strip, roughly what kind of roll do you need in terms of distance, and what's your airspeed when you can finally rotate?
Well, the 38, we could get off with a full load in an easy 4,000 feet, and less than that usually. The grass slowed you up a little bit over an asphalted runway. And we like to get 100 miles an hour. The minimum control speed on the 38 was roughly 120 miles an hour, and I'm not sure we knew that then. They didn't talk about much on minimum control, but that was one of the 38's most critical moments when it had a load on. If you lost an engine on takeoff, the thing could roll over on its back very quickly.
Right. So when did you actually show up in Europe or in England? What month and date, if you can remember?
We got in there the end of May before D-Day. And I've forgotten the date, but we went over on the Queen Elizabeth. And, 5 days and you're there. So we made it before D-Day.
When you think about D-Day, that's like a great moment of the 20th century. What kind of notice did you receive? Did it bring everybody in a room and say, okay, we're making the invasion tomorrow? Or how did that go about?
They shut the airfield down, told us to paint black and white stripes around the fuselage and the wings. And when they shut the airfield down, anybody that was on the airfield stayed on the airfield. And this was just the evening before the 6th.
Was on the 5th. Oh, my God. So did you fly on D-Day at all?
No, I flew right after that. We were assigned to covering the invasion fleet in the channel. And the 38s did most of the close escort work on the invasion fleet because it was so easy to identify the airplane from the ground. But they still shot at us. But actually, D-Day was a big disappointment. We'd anticipated very heavy reaction from the Luftwaffe, and it didn't occur.
So what altitude were you flying over the channel? I mean, in your mind, do you remember?
It'd be mid-altitudes in the 8,000 to 10,000 feet.
So if you're going back in your memories, what does that look like? I mean, I can imagine you sitting in your P-38 and you're looking down at the water. Tell me what you see.
A vast amount of ships. Of all kinds, it was mind-boggling, and the thought that came to me was, you know, when I was in high school, I joined the California Air National Guard, and we had an airfield right in Griffith Park in the city of Los Angeles, and it was right across from Grand Central Air Terminal in Glendale, which was a major airfield in those days. And we went on maneuvers in September 1940 in the state of Washington. And we didn't have anything. We were flying old aircraft and such as the old, we had Douglas O-38s, which were biplane fabric covered, built by Douglas in the early 30s. And we had two brand new O-47s, were built by North American. But the ground forces on these maneuvers in 1940 literally had nothing. They had crossed the 2x4s for mortars and things like that. And here we are 2.5 years later, and you're looking at this vast armada of equipment and everything that had been stored in England. I mean, thousands and thousands of trucks and every imaginable thing, and we supplied most of it. So it was really overwhelming.
Wow, did you feel a sense of pride? What's going through your soul?
Absolutely. And maybe it was just because of this earlier experience that I had. It was an outstanding moment. I would find it difficult to find the correct words to describe it.
Well, here's a question that I wonder. When you're flying and you're in World War II and you're seeing all this, did you have any animosity or anger at the Germans? I mean, I want to get inside your head as a warrior, so to speak.
I don't remember hating them, but we were at war, and of course, Kunkel isn't exactly an Irish name. My middle name's Kelly, and that's a little more Irish. But I kept thinking I'm probably going to meet some of my relatives over here.
Huh. Okay. So you get the. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I think probably at that time there were more animosity against the Japanese than there were the Germans.
Right. You know, so you fly and you're getting your feet wet in combat, and then okay, now we've landed on D-Day and we're moving into Europe. Describe the kind of missions you flew then. Were they're all, you know, 9th Air Force, you were primarily, as you said, moving mud. Describe a typical mission.
Well, a typical mission for the P-38s was probably deeper than the P-47s. We didn't do as much close support work with the infantry that the P-47s did. We did a lot of armed reconnaissance. We'd pack on one or two bombs or one bomb and a drop tank, and we'd go deeper in after transportation and anything that moved. So our typical mission was really armed reconnaissance. We'd have an area to work and targets of opportunity, and there were plenty of them.
So when you're saying armed recon, do you have cameras on there, or are you just making visual?
No, they just called it armed reconnaissance because you were ready for any target. We weren't after pictures or anything like that. It was a common term at that time.
Okay.
Our group was a P-47 group in training in the U.S., and I joined them as a P-38 pilot because they switched from P-47s in England to P-38s. And one of the reasons they were switched is that the group CO and the major part of the experience of the group had first experience on napalm down at Eglin Field. And we were the first group to carry napalm in combat. So we did some napalm missions. Some of them are quite well known. And
well, like what? Tell me about one. Tell me about a napalm mission.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and I didn't do this. I'd have to go back and refresh my memory of the name of the islands that we napalmed, and they surrendered while we were napalming them. We used napalm. Particularly as the Germans were withdrawing from Normandy, one particular mission stood out in my mind. We caught them on the third bend of the Seine River in from Le Havre, and they were pulling out across the bridges of the Seine. And when we hit them with napalm, it was quite an experience and a very successful mission.
So when you're flying over, I mean, how many on a napalm mission? We'll stay on that. How many planes is this? 4 or 8, 16, 12?
Usually 12 to or 4 flights to 16. Very seldom do we fly a group mission. I think probably one of the the most vivid memories I have of napalm was. We were getting ready for the first napalm mission, and they were loading the napalm this particular evening. And we saw a column. I just came out of the officers' club at Andover, and Colonel Nichols, our group commander, came out right behind me, and he said, "My gosh," he said, "look at all that smoke coming up from the dispersal area." He said, "Let's get down and see what it is." So he and I got in the Jeep and went down there. And what had happened, one of the mechanics had triggered off a napalm tank underneath the P-38, and there was napalm burning all over the place, with bombs that had been dispersed around the revetment area. We lost 4 P-38s and a couple firemen from the local Andover Fire Department were killed. It was a big mess.
Huh.
Well, that was our first experience in what napalm could do, and that was before we even dropped the first tank.
And how many? I'm curious. How many napalm missions did you fly then?
I really don't remember how many we flew. probably in Normandy, maybe five or six napalm missions as a squadron. The rest of their squadrons were all flown about the same.
Because you think about napalm as more of a Vietnam War weapon.
Yes.
And,
yep. They used it in Korea. But,
yeah.
And there was quite a bit of it used in Europe. In the Pacific, I think the Marines used quite a bit. But I'm not sure of that.
Now, are you when you're dropping napalm? What level? At what altitude do you let it go?
Very right down on the deck. You went in very low, and you're right down amongst all the heavy flak. So you know they're even throwing rocks at you down at that altitude.
Sure. And are you in a trail formation, or are you in a finger four?
Never get in trail formation.
Yeah.
they'd be leading the leader and hitting you.
Well, I have to ask for people who are listening. I wonder how that would work. But
don't do it.
Yeah. Okay.
And never follow a smoke trail from the guns either.
Oh, sure.
Off to the side. And the beautiful thing about it. 38 is if you were coming in on a target, you could kick that rudder a little bit and get the ball off, so you look like you're flying one way, but you're really going another way, and then put that ball in the center when you pull the trigger.
So, did you what did you think of the P-38 versus the P-47?
Well, when I was in college, you had to be 21 years of age to be a cadet. And you had to have 2 years of college prior to the beginning of the war. And so I was trying to get my 2 years of college in and trying to get old enough. And I had a job at North American for the summer of 1941. And at North American, I worked on the first 10 P-51s built. And these were A models. In fact, the first 10, 8 of them went to the RAF. And 2 of them went to the Air Force. And one of those airplanes is back at the EAA Museum, one of those first 10.
Huh.
And so they were Allison-powered, and therefore they were not altitude airplanes. And so I knew about the P-38, and when school started, I went to Lockheed and got a job on Graveyard working on P-38 wings. So I was very familiar with the P-38, and I thought it was a great airplane. And when I went on active duty as a cadet, I told them I wanted to fly P-38s and I wanted to go to England. So, not that they listened to me, but it worked out that way.
Wow. How about handling-wise? You flew P-47s and P-38s. Any impressions on how the airplane actually handled?
Well, the plane handled extremely well, in my opinion. It was a tight turner. You could do a spiral climb that none of the single engine airplanes could follow you. And with my limited experience, I was more than happy flying it. It was interesting about the 30. When you talk about the 38, the 38. Of course, was designed in 1937 and really flew first in 1939, so it was an early flyer, and it was designed as a high-altitude interceptor. And so when we started using it, it did everything well, some things better than others, but I never felt overwhelmed by tangling with a P-47 or a P-51, and I got to fly all three of them. And I flew 38s against some pretty sharp P-51 pilots, and it was usually the ability of the individual more than the airplane.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. You know, you think about airplanes, but airplane performance statistics, but the reality is the thinking human inside the cockpit is the dominant factor.
Well, it is. And, you know, the 51, the P-47 was a lousy climb airplane. And so they put the big prop on it and water injection, and they got it to perform pretty well. In the 51, they had to go to the Merlin engine in order to get a real combat airplane out of it. The P-38 soldiered along on pretty much the original design. But, you know, Lockheed built two airplanes. They called them P-38Ks. And they changed they put the high efficiency propellers on them and made some changes in the engine. And the airplane was 40 miles an hour faster than the latest and greatest P-38, and it went to 45,000 feet. And that airplane was never built by Lockheed in production because the War Production Board turned them down on allowing them to shut down the line to make the changes in the 38. So we went the whole way through the war with the old toothpick props, and we didn't have the ultimate performance that the airplane was capable of. So it was a little P-38 propaganda, I guess, or whatever. So we used to tell our opposing 47 and 51 pilots that they got all the good stuff, and we did with what we had.
Well, that's a good time to now talk about September of 1944, when you had your mission where you were awarded the DSC. What day was that? September 16th.
September 16th, 1944 at 5:45 in the evening.
Holy smokes! Okay, well, you've got it down. So tell us about September 16th, 1944, from wherever you want to start.
Well, it goes back a little ways back. We, late in August, one of our sister P-38 groups had an encounter with the Luftwaffe, and the Luftwaffe was vectored in on them, came in at their 6 o'clock. They didn't pick them up, and they lost over half a squadron in that engagement. And what was happening, the Luftwaffe started on a day where you'd have some cumulus clouds, broken or from scattered to broken. They would vector the fighters in against the our low-level aircraft, and they'd bring them in at 6 o'clock under radar control. And so we started having this experience. We had two occasions in August of 44 where, and I was involved in both of them, where they vectored aircraft in. And the first indication we had, they were coming in at our 6 o'clock in a number of aircraft. And so we started putting people in the what we call Purple Heart Corner, the last flight of the in the squadron, and we put some experienced people back there. And so on September 16th, that was my spot. I had a wingman who went, which I would explain that we were running out of supplies in September. And of all kinds, bombs and even fuel. And so apparently we had some water in our fuel, and the fellow who was flying with me returned to base. And so I'm more or less by myself in that last element. We were up, we were scheduled into Aachen on a low-level mission, the full group. We had three squadrons in the air. Two of the squadrons were down dive bombing and strafing the Germans who were trying to reinforce Aachen. Aachen was the first city that we, the first major city that we were trying to take in Germany. And so we were flying top cover for them. And I think I spent more time looking backwards than I did forwards, and I spotted two flights of enemy aircraft coming in on us. I very carefully called the brake, and I broke to the left, which there was one group coming in about 45 degrees to us, and the other coming in on the other side. And so I broke into the flight on the left-hand side, thinking that the whole squadron would be following me. And it became apparent very quickly that they didn't turn with me, and I was on my own. For whatever the reason, the other flight, other than the one that I was going to go right through the middle of, dropped in on my tail, and they hit me pretty hard and caught fire. I think it was probably the hydraulic system, which was the back of the pilot nacelle on the 38. And from then on, we were involved, heavily engaged with a number of enemy aircraft. I really don't remember too much about the air battle. I fired at a number of aircraft. I was concerned about the number of aircraft and my ammunition. What seemed a lifetime, I was on the tail of an FW-190, and I noticed in my provisional vision I could see some hits out on my left wingtip, and whoever was on my tail just walked them up the wing and until he hit the left engine and the reserve and main tank on the left side. There was a cold air vent in the 38 right at your left knee, and it looked like a blowtorch all of a sudden, which was not good. And I think probably within a microsecond, the airplane blew up. I do not remember trying to release the canopy. I don't remember even pulling my safety belt and shoulder harness, and or making preparation to bail out. It just went. My next recollection was I was falling through a cloud. And I knew the clouds were about 5,000 feet above the ground level. When I came out the bottom of the cloud, I was facing up, and I thought I was behind German territory. In fact, I thought I was east of Aachen, and I was. I rolled over and started falling face down until the ground looked like it was getting real close, and I pulled the ripcord, and the chute blossomed. I think that or thinking that I was behind German lines, I had a shoulder holster with a 45 in it. I unbuckled the two lower straps on the chute, got the 45 out, and dropped it. I didn't realize my hands were burnt. And then probably in an instant, I came down in the courtyard of a red brick building. I could identify it today if I could find the building. There was an tree in the middle of the courtyard, and the chute hung up in that and jerked me to a stop. I guess I got out of the chute, and I didn't realize my hands were burned and my face was burned. I don't have too much of a recollection. I thought it was getting dark, and which would have been like hours later because we had double British summertime. But I think in looking back, it was probably because my face was badly burned. And next recollection I had my 45, and I was along a hedgerow, along a little roadway, and I saw some guys down in the ditch, and I thought they were German. and I saw that they had net on their helmets like our guys had. And so, sure enough, they were infantry. They'd seen and witnessed most of the fight. The 1st Infantry Division had moved up and taken a little town called Ellendorf, which was just east of Aachen. And it was the 1st Infantry Division, 16th Regiment, and 27th Regiment. And they'd seen my chute, and they sent these people out to pick me up. And that was it. They picked me up and took me back, put me in some type of an ambulance, and I ended up in a back hospital. So that was about all I knew about it. I remember the doctors talking to me sometime during the night while they took me into the emergency room and treated my burns. It was just, you know, I was in the hospital. I ended up in the American hospital in Paris. And when they brought me in, this infantry lieutenant walked over to me and says, "Hell, I know you. We picked you up." And so he had been hit the next day and had witnessed a good part of my combat. And I learned more from him than I could remember. His name was Leonard Scott, and he was from the Dalles, Oregon. And I've tried my best to find him all these years and have never located him. I know that he made it through the war. He was discharged from the service in Fort Lewis, Washington, but I've never found it.
Jim, that story is so riveting. But just to make it clear, when you turned into that squadron of German airplanes, how many do you estimate there were?
I had no idea. The infantry, apparently, and I'm not even sure of this, but apparently when I was picked up, they took me to, I think, the regimental commander of the 16th Infantry, I think. And anyway, somebody either wrote a letter or did something with my group, and the infantry estimated that there were 20 to 20 plus aircraft that I was involved with, which I have no idea whether that's correct or not.
How many did you, did you shot down a few, didn't you?
At the time, I had supposedly confirmed 5. The way it worked out, it's still in my record, but a few years ago, I got a hold of the CD that has confirmed victories for the Air Force, and I hadn't seen it before, and I don't think it came out until, you know, fairly recent, and I was actually given confirmation of 2. Now, how on earth they ever confirmed those, I'll never know. You know, you had to have your gun camera, you had to have a witness. If I had any kind of a witness, it would have only been the infantry. So how they confirmed 2 for me, I don't know.
We're so close to the Pentagon. Sometimes they ask us to get the coffee. This is Warbird Radio.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to the all-new Warbird Radio Live channel. We're happy to be back on the air right across from the runway at Washington Reagan International Airport. Be sure and tune in Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern each week for Warbird Radio Live, followed by a new episode of one of our top-tier shows like the R.C. Scale Builder Show, Hartman & Hines, Over the Front, and the all-new Texas Warbird Report and Wings Over New Zealand show. Listen, this station is all about community, so please join up with us on Tuesday nights and call in and become part of the fun and part of the family. Thanks again for tuning in, and join us Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Live from Washington, D.C., This is Warbird Radio.
Welcome back to Warbird Radio Presents. I'm John Mollison, and now we conclude the James Kunkel story.
Spent 16 weeks in the hospital, and total. And I was shot down in September. In November, I actually went back to the group, and I was ready to get back into flying again. And a great disappointment when I got back to the group. You know, I think I gave you a little hint on Kunk's Klunk was an older airplane that came from the 8th Air Force. And so when I went back to the group in November, they delivered a brand new P-38, and that was going to be my airplane. And I was all set, and the flight surgeon put me back in the hospital with a cast on my back. Apparently, I had an injury that they hadn't picked up in the prior hospital. So I spent another 4, 5, 6 weeks in England and went back to the group again in January to start flying. And unbeknownst to me, somebody had put a recommendation in for a decoration, and I ended up going down to General Spotts' headquarters, and I did receive the Distinguished Service Cross. At the time I received it, I don't think I even knew what a Distinguished Service Cross was. And when I went back to the group, the flight surgeon said that I was finished flying as far as he was concerned, and they sent me home.
I can only imagine what that must have been like for those, you know, that dogfight. You know, you got 20 plus Germans and you, and I can only imagine how hard that is to remember. You had to be on instinct and training.
Well, it's kind of a blur. You know what you're doing. I don't recall any type of, I'm sure there was no panic or anything like that. That was the situation. That was it.
Right. Yeah. You just react and move forward. Okay. So, yeah. So here's the question that I like to ask veterans of any type of combat. Somehow that experience changed you or prepared you for your future life. Can you describe how it did?
I really have never thought of it. It was just an experience, I guess. I never had any afterthoughts of it. I never had lost a single night's sleep over it. It happened. It was over, and it came out well.
So, what'd you do after World War II? What kind of life did you lead?
Well, I wanted to fly our first jets, and when I came home from combat, I got probably the best job in the Air Force. I went to Portland, Oregon, and I became the maintenance officer for the sub depot there. And I got to fly everything from L-5s to Stearmans to the P-51H to B-24s. I flew everything. And so I wanted to fly the jets, and so I stayed in the service until 1948. Went back to Germany, which was a tremendous experience to be back in Germany during the beginning of the Reconstruction. Spent a little over a year in Germany, came back and went to the Sumter, South Carolina with the 20th Fighter Group, P-84s, and enjoyed a year there flying. Got to do the first dive bombing test on the P-84 at Eglin Field, which became quite a story. That's described somewhat in Don Lopez's book called Fighter Pilot Heaven. you know, Don was the curator of the Air and Space Museum, the assistant, I guess he was, and an old friend. And so in 1948, I decided that it was time to get out of the Air Force, and I wanted to get involved in business. And so I came home, got involved in a little paper company, and it lasted a couple of years, enjoyed it very much. We were relatively successful and developed a product called No Bugs, My Lady Shelf Paper that sold like a son of a gun.
No bug? What's that?
No Bugs, My Lady Shelf Paper was shelf paper that you could put in your with your dishes and in drawers and so forth, and it would kill insects like ants or anything, and it became probably the largest single paper item in the country for a few years. But we had a little company called Paper Products Incorporated, and we figured out how to put the lindane on paper, and so we had No Bugs, My Lady Shelf Paper.
That sounds kind of cool.
Well, it took me flying.
Yeah.
So I made up my mind when I left the service that I was going to get out and make enough money so I could have an airplane.
So
it all worked out. But after a couple of years in the paper business, which was kind of a family deal, I started doing development work in real estate and never stopped. In fact, we're still at it today.
Hmm. So you're still working?
My son has a facility up in Santa Maria called Central Coast Jet Center that he's doing very well with, and we built the hangars, and we've built a number of air cargo facilities. Our last job was at Dulles in Washington. We built the air cargo buildings there and leased them. We have sold those now, but I have a joint venture with a group in Washington. But we build air cargo buildings in Guam and Hawaii and Alaska and all over the place. And everything we built, we leased. We didn't do contract work.
Sure. Well, I got a question for you. I want to go back to your time in Germany. You were there during the Reconstruction. What was the attitude of the German people, or what was that like? I mean, you're obviously the victors over a terribly defeated, you know, nation. What was that like to see?
Well, it was kind of surprising. We had, you know, there were a number of people who weren't going to give up. And we had a lot of experience. I was based at Neubiberg, which is just south of the outskirts of Munich. And we had a number of occasions where people would shoot into the base and things like that. There was nothing serious. We did run across a lot of refugees, people out of Eastern Germany who, you know, were trying to escape from the Russians. We had some contact with those people, but being flying, and we flew every day. The general who was in command of the 70th fighter wing there in southern Germany insisted that our engines would be running at 6 o'clock in the morning, and with weather permitting, we'd have airplanes in the air right after that. This was before the Iron Curtain. We were flying into East Germany on a regular basis until the Russians, you know, they shut down Berlin. Of course, I had just left Germany prior to all of that. But it was quite an experience being in Germany. We were based naturally. We were down in Bavaria, south of, you know, right south of Munich, which is the Alps, and it was the least damaged portion of Germany. Munich was a wreck when we first went back. So, but I had friends all over Europe, and I'd go in and work at Bremen, Frankfurt, any number of cities that had been literally destroyed. So we saw a lot, and it was quite an experience.
I'm curious to know, did you ever have any interaction with the Russians when post-war?
No, I didn't. I saw them in action up in Bremen. I had friends up there in the ATC, which Air Transport Command, and the Russians were in Bremen at the sub-10s, and we let them take out all kinds of equipment. I never understood why they could come into our area and confiscate German equipment. Apparently, we had enough of it, and so we let them have some too, but it just didn't make sense. But whatever little contact I had with them, they were not friendly people.
Yeah. Huh. And you left before the Berlin airlift thing.
Yes, that was prior to the Berlin. But they shut down. You know, when I first went back to Germany, first week I was back there, the Yugoslavs had shot down one of our C-47s. And right after I arrived at Mühleberg, they shot down a second C-47. And so right south of Mühleberg, there were 300 brand new B-17s in a field. They'd been flown in from England and parked there. So they were going to take one of the 17s and fully arm it and run it on the the C-47 route. And we were going to put a couple flights of Mustangs above it, and we were going to find out about this problem of being shot at. So after that happened, then slowly the Iron Curtain started coming down. We weren't permitted to go over into East Germany any longer, and the Cold War started.
Right.
But, you know, but we never did, in my humble opinion, we should have run that that B-17 down, and we should have clobbered them, but we didn't. And to my thinking, this was the beginning of the problem in Korea and the problem with Russia. We backed away, and we seem to be doing that even today. Well, that's what I found. It was during that period in Germany that as far as I'm concerned, that was the beginning of the Cold War. I think that if I had to guess, old General Patton was correct.
Right, just to keep moving.
Differences before, when we still had a tremendous army. Right. But, you know, by the time I went back to Germany in the spring of 1946, the Air Force, we'd lost all our people, all of our experience. The Army was down to kids that had been drafted at the end of the war and just serving their time. And so we were in pretty poor shape in Europe at that time. We had some P-80s. When I first went to Europe, supposedly I was going to be with the P-80 squadrons, and we couldn't keep them in flying, and so we took them up to Bremen and put them on a carrier and sent them back to the U.S. So we had some T-51s and some P-47s, and that was it.
Yeah, speaking of P-51s, you mentioned you flew the H model. What was that much of a difference between the D model?
That was one great airplane, in my opinion. I flew them in Portland, Oregon. You know, the first flight of the T-51H was, if I remember correctly, was in January 1945. So I was based in Portland, and we were going to become an OTU for the P-47H. And so I got to fly some of the early acceptance flights on it. I got to fly it with 90 inches of manifold pressure. It was 700 pounds lighter than a D. I thought it was a great airplane. I've read some articles like Chuck Digger said it wasn't as good as a D because it vibrated. It did. It was a lighter airplane. But we flew it against the P-59, the first jet, and it would climb all over a P-59.
Did you ever fly the P-59?
I got checked out. I didn't really get to fly it. I got checked out in it, so I can say I flew it. But I didn't get much time in it.
Yeah.
So I flew our first three jets. I flew the 59, the 80, and the 84.
Wow. You know, Jim, your experience with aviation is tremendous. And you're still, how often do you get up in an airplane today?
Oh, I see. I shot two landings on Sunday. I fly at least every week. My twin's just coming out of an extended annual inspection, so I'm going to fly it in the next few days. I have a little biplane that I fly on warm days, not on cold ones. And so my son has, we actually have six airplanes and half of another one.
Wow. Well, this has been just an absolute joy, and thank you for allowing us to talk to you, and thanks for sharing your stories. Jim, you're drawing your P-38. It was a highlight of last year and a pure honor. And thank you for letting me into your life like you have.
Well, I certainly appreciate you doing it. It brought back a lot of memories. That old girl was quite an airplane. And when I first looked at it, I thought, oh, boy. And I put a little card together. Maybe I ought to send you one about how we named it Punk's Clunk.
Well, how did you name it Kunk's Clunk?
Pardon?
What is that story?
Well, I went on leave, and I had a real nice J-15. There was pretty fresh airplane, and somebody, and I've forgotten now who got shot down in it. So I came back, and what had happened, you know, the 8th Air Force turned in all the 38s and transitioned into the Mustang. So the 9th Air Force got all those airplanes. And so when I came back, my new airplane was a J-10. And I took one look at it, and holy criminy, it was old by combat standards, but probably had a couple hundred hours on it. And so I thought, well, I'll just name it Kunk's Clunk. Clunk rhymed with Kunk, and Kunk was part of my name. And so, but it turned out to be a really great airplane. And but we got it from the 8th Air Force.
Well, it's too bad. It's now it's probably in a million toasters right now.
Well, I've got a picture of, you know, they found the airplane in, one was in the late 90s. They were excavating at Ellendorf, Germany. They were excavating for a new building, and they came across this wreckage. Well, it turned out to be my airplane. And I have a picture of this pile of trash with, you can recognize some half blocks of Allison engines and some twisted props. And interestingly enough, in the report to the German government, which apparently they have to do when they find a wartime wreckage with armament, they said there was some ammunition spread around the wreckage, in the wreckage. And one of my big concerns during that air battle was that there were so many things to shoot at. I thought, we only carried 300 rounds per gun plus 130 20-millimeter shells. And I thought, this is no place to run out of ammunition. And so that was a concern of mine. And so I was very happy to hear there was still some sprinkled around in the wreck.
Oh, did anybody ever think to take any of those pieces and send you one?
That's another story. I was corresponding with a gentleman in Holland, and he was a historian of some renown, and he's the one that actually got the whole story together about my airplane and me, and he was in contact with the people who were doing the excavation of the airplane, and all of a sudden, he was like 40 years old, and he had discovered something like 600 aircraft in the area where he lived, where Holland and Belgium and Germany came together, which included Aachen, in the area where I was engaged. And all of a sudden, he passed away. He was arranging for me to get a prop, a bent prop, and maybe a couple other little chunks of it. And what happened to him, I don't know. I've tried to find out that all of his... He wrote a book called Boulder Platen about it's a wonderful book about the air raids on the 1st of January, mm-hmm. of 1945.
Yeah.
Where the guys from Botany did so well. The 362nd group.
352nd.
Yeah, well, that was good. Colonel Myers, who did so well that day, he and I got our Distinguished Service Cross the same day from SWATS at the same time. And so, he had written this excellent book on that mission. And so when he passed away, the Dutch government has all of his manuscripts and all of his information, and I haven't been able to get them to answer me. If there's anything in there to tell me who had those pieces of my airplane. But he did have these photographs that were taken at the time. I have copies of those.
Well, you know, honestly, Jim, if you can send me a scan of those pictures, I'll see what I can do with people I know in Europe, and we'll see if we can't find out where your plane is.
Yeah, there's in fact, I have the whole file from this gentleman, so I can send you some of that information. That'd be very easy.
All right. Well, let's see what we can do.
Well, if you ever want to do a jet, do a P-84, you know, that's a forgotten airplane. It was very big in Korea, but it's definitely in the shadow of the F-86.
I'm totally pleased with my artwork of Kunk's Klunk, even though it was totally blown out of the sky. In fact, we've got a pretty good idea that pieces of his airplane have survived, and they were recently dug up in an excavation. However, though pieces of Jim's P-38 remained buried for so many years, the truth of the matter is this. The business of life comes down to decisions, this or that, black or white, left or right, run or fight. I don't know what battles you're facing, but I do hope that you can take this time, maybe right now, to decide that when the threat comes, you're going to do the right thing that represents you, your friends, your country, best. Thank you for listening. This is John Mollison for Warbird Radio Presents. And if you'd like to have a P-38 signed by James Kunkel himself, visit me at johnmollison.com. And thanks again for listening.